Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Students around the world are asking questions about God, the truth, and the meaning of their lives. Your gift will put top-notch Catholic intellectuals in front of students who are seeking. Go to ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students to transform a student's life today. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/support-students.
So for our first two installments, we treated anger as a kind of morally neutral feature of human life, but with an eye to anger as a potentially good feature in human life. We were already minded in that direction, and so we were solicitous to tease out insights in that direction. But even to speak of it as a morally neutral phenomenon is already to misspeak, because insofar as it is, it's good. Insofar as God supplied it, he intends it for good. And so when we talk about the morality of anger, specifically its virtuous formation, we're just teasing out that metaphysical insight as we seek in this post-fall world to heal and to grow what stands in need of healing and growing. So we've said that anger regards the evil of injury and it regards the good of vindication. And so we're going to look to how these movements or this movement is potentially good if incorporated in a virtuous formation. So I'm going to focus on a couple of phenomena, just kind of simple phenomena, which should correspond with our experience, but which we can together interrogate in the course of this lecture, and then the conversation to follow tomorrow morning. In that, anger, I think, is meant in part to safeguard the integrity of the human person. All right, to safeguard the integrity of the human person. And then to facilitate genuine vulnerability in human relationship. Those are going to be the two big things. One way in which we could kind of summarize that is that it provides impetus to virtuous action. All right, it seeks to, as we've said, rectify, restore, reconcile, and we'll follow up all of those insights. When describing the passions in general, but we can think about this with application to anger, it's helpful to have some images, and we have already adduced several images so as to give us something on which to work. And trying to come up with a good image for the passions with an eye towards their kind of place in virtuous formation, I have the idea that they can be described as hydroelectric levees. Bear with me. So I was just talking to somebody who works in nuclear power, and we were talking about the advantages and disadvantages of each, you know, clean energy source or alternate energy source, because they all come with advantages and disadvantages. And certainly when thinking about hydroelectric power, we all have our associated advantages and disadvantages. Okay, so originally I was going to propose that the passions are like a dam, and the reason for which is this, but then I will change my image so as to accommodate the way in which this first image stinks. So if you think about the passions as a dam, all right, that affords you certain advantages. Why? Well, think of a river, a kind of wild river. I will take the Nile River, about which I know very little, but at present, I am reading a novel written by Agatha Christie, which is set on the Nile River. So it seems appropriate. So if we were to dam the Nile River with its many cataracts, that might afford certain advantages, depending upon where you are located on the Nile River. For those who rely upon the river's flooding so as to make their fields, good for agriculture, it might introduce a little bit more of a rhythm or a little bit more of regularity into that process, and it might be able to ensure that the irrigation from which they could draw was just kind of more humane, was incorporated in human culture. For those who try to navigate on the river, it might ensure a little less in the way of volatility around said cataracts, because I'm assuming that the water would back up. Notice that I actually checked none of the facts. I'm just reasoning upon what I think might be the case. Woo! Right. And then, I don't know if they were to do it in such a fashion at such a point in the river, it might afford, the advantage of a national recreation area if Egyptians are as interested in such things as Americans are. So you would now have the opportunity to go to the Nile beach rather than simply being terrified of the Nile floods. The reason I don't like this image is because it's an image that we will typically associate with a kind of repression or even oppression. Because what the dam does to the river is effectively ruin it. so you can think of the example of the Hetchy Hetch Valley. Have you ever heard of the Hetchy Hetch Valley? Show of hands. Wow, that's a grand three. All right, perfect. Raise your hands if you've heard of the Yosemite Valley. Okay, so the reason for which you have heard of the Yosemite Valley is because you've been exposed to its beauty. But the Hetchy Hetch Valley is just as beautiful. They just chose to dam that river and not the Merced. Which is a shame, but it's what it is, right? So we're just downstream of that fact. But when you dam a river, you effectively ruin the things that are upstream of it, and you cover them, right? You don't actually address them. So I'm proposing to you, I can't even take myself seriously. I'm proposing to you the image of hydraulic levees, okay? Because levees afford a certain discipline to the flow of the river. They safeguard against destructive flooding, but in certain instances, they can actually help clean the river whilst drawing power for higher use. All right, so they get you some of the advantages of the dam. They account for some of said disadvantages in less destructive fashion. Also, they don't exist, so I made this up. this is all in my mind. So what we're trying to get with virtuous formation of passions is something like discipline, training, education. But when we begin to introduce the notion of repression or oppression, we want to check that and think about it more along the lines of empowerment or emboldening. Okay, so the virtues aren't like a 19th century schoolmarm, which says to the passions, all right, I don't actually know what follows upon said glance, but you get the idea. Right, the virtues don't look at the passions with a kind of look of mild disappointment bridging on scorn. All right, they look at the passions in such a way as to introduce them into a human culture and to draw their power for a genuine human use, lest they devolve into something brutal or bestial. Okay, so that's the basic idea. That's the basic proposal. But we have to approach it with a certain sense of caution. Okay, with a certain sense of caution. Because the Christian tradition is especially nervous about anger, and for good reason. In part, because of the conversation which transpires among the ancients, among the pagans, or among the ancient Christians, but among the ancients, regarding it. And here we can think especially of the Stoics. Now, Stoicism is coming back into vogue. So many of you, I'm sure, will have heard of Stoicism in various 21st century forms. But the Stoic counterargument, in its rough contours, is that anger is really, really ugly, and you don't need it. So you shouldn't risk it, okay? Anger is really, really ugly, and you don't need it, so you shouldn't risk it. Here's a small passage from Seneca's work on anger, De Ira. You have demanded, Novatus, that I write on how anger can be alleviated. I think that you were right to have a particular dread of this, the most hideous and frenzied of all emotions. The others have something quiet and placid to them, whereas anger is all excitement and impulse, raving with a desire that is utterly inhuman for instruments of pain and reparations in blood. Careless of itself, so long as it harms the other, it rushes onto the very spear points, greedy for vengeance that draws down the avenger with it. Okay. So in the Stoic estimation, there's a whole kind of metaphysics and anthropology that backs this judgment. And when I say the Stoic tradition, we're talking about people who write over the course of hundreds of years. So there's going to be differences among them in their particular thought, their peculiar kind of point of view. But this is a broad brushstroke way to characterize Seneca, Chrysippus, and also Cicero, who, while not himself a Stoic, found the Stoic position in these matters to be most excellent. Their sense is this: secondary goods aren't really goods. We only think so because of a misvaluation. All right? There's only one good, They're kind of ethical monists, which is the good of virtue. All other putative goods are not goods. They're just misvaluated attachments. So like life, for instance. That would be a secondary good, and as a result of which, a misvalued non-good by their judgment. All right? So there is only the primary good of virtue, which is according to reason. What we find, on their estimation, is that emotions are just false judgments begotten of this misvaluation, which are prompted by various stimuli or various impulses that arise kind of attendant upon our engagement with our environment. So if you think falsely, for instance, that your sister or brother ought to live a long life, right, unto fullness of age, you think falsely, right? Because ultimately, the only thing to which you ought be attached is virtue. But in light of that false judgment, when your brother or sister dies, God forbid, at a young age, the grief that you experience, the anger that arises in your heart, is a subsequent false judgment, all right? So it's a kind of network of false judgments which arise at root from a misvaluation. All right, so poor valuations eventuate in poor judgments, causing a kind of irrational and therefore destructive upheaval in the soul. And so it's for this reason that, as many of us have heard it described, the Stoics argue for a kind of extirpation of the passions, a kind of rooting out of the passions, and a kind of stance of apathy. All right? So there's a classic example cited in the Stoic tradition where a father is informed that his son has tragically died, to which the father responds with tranquil features, "I already knew that I had begotten a mortal." Okay? Now, on this reading, or in this tradition, anger seems most to be rooted out, in part because of its vehemence. So anger and grief are two emotions upon which they focus with exceptional care. So what they'll say is that to engage with anger is, on the one hand, just misprision. It's a misvaluation of the things at stake. And it's simply not worth the risk. And here they're in conversation with the Peripatetics, right, which are the disciples or the school of Aristotle, who are going to make the types of arguments which we have already heard. Namely, that anger is something natural. It issues from the sense or sensitive appetite, that it can be a kind of motive force for virtuous action or virtuous activity. And so they say in response, it's just too dangerous. It is too much given to excess, all right? And that motive power which you seek can be supplied by reason itself. So why rely upon passion to supply a motive force which you could simply command with the mind? Okay, so we have the lay of the land. You might think that seems reasonable, or you might think that seems unreasonable. But what I'm going to propose to you is a kind of version of the peripatetic, that is, in certain senses, Thomistic account, which reads these types of critiques and takes them as not unfounded, right, and sensible in some way, shape, or form. So the proposal is a kind of virtuous anger. All right, a kind of virtuous anger. Now, you could just assume the anthropology which Aristotle and St. Thomas supply and then argue on the basis of it that we need a virtue in order to inform this part of the human life. Okay, so like we heard Sister describe, there are different powers, we might call them faculties or even simply capacities, through which the human soul engages with its environment. These powers aren't anything new to us, right? We've already thought about them at length. The intellect, the will, and then what we've called the sense or sensitive appetite. We heard Sister describe the irascible power and the concupiscible power as two expressions of that sense or sensitive appetite, which concerns sense goods simply, or sense goods with a kind of difficulty, all right? Sense goods with a kind of complexity to them, I suppose we could say that as well. So we're looking for a kind of restraint with respect to the concupiscible power. We're looking for a kind of solidity or firmness with respect to the irascible power, lest we be, you know, caught unawares, or otherwise thrown for a loop. So within this setting, Aristotle will argue that there is a virtue which pertains to each aspect of our human life, each aspect of our human manifold, to speak in crass terms. All right, so you've got the virtues of the mind, you've got the virtues of the heart, but with respect to the appetites, he'll say, okay, in the concupiscible power, you have these six basic passions, which Sister listed: love, desire, what we have called at this point delight, or pleasure, or joy. And then those all concern the good, but with respect to the evil, we have hatred, aversion, and sorrow. And so Aristotle will say something like what we call the virtue of temperance is the virtue which informs those movements of the concupiscible power. All right? Sister listed further, in addition to those six, we have another five. So hope and despair concern the good. Hope determines that it's possible, despair determines that it's impossible, and so they respond in opposite fashion. All right? The virtue which corresponds to these passions of the concupiscible power we call magnanimity. All right? And then you have another couplet. All right? So you have fear and daring, all right, which regard a threatening or imminent evil. Fear cowers before it, daring launches at it. The appropriate virtue in that case would be fortitude, or what we sometimes call courage or bravery. And then you have anger, which is not paired, all right, which exists in a kind of splendid isolation. And the virtue which applies in this case is called in the tradition meekness, all right? Meekness. So that's one way in which we could, you know, argue for the need to, you know, have or cultivate some sense of and also realize in our lives some place for virtuous passion, in this case, virtuous anger. But that's to assume the anthropology which we have to argue for. So I'm going to do something different. I'm going to do a kind of phenomenological approach to the realities that are at stake. Okay. So here we are in the 21st century. And I think we would probably agree, maybe there would be some people who would hesitate to agree, but at least in some way, shape, or form, we would probably agree that there's a certain risk to the over-manifestation of anger at present, whether personally or societally. So I think we've come to the recognition that not all difficulties or not all suffered injustices need to be vocalized. Not all offenses need to be worked through. All right, there's a kind of subtle temptation in a victimization culture to seize upon every opportunity as currency for control or for manipulation or for power politics. And we've already begun to see how that just hollows out our institutions, how it undermines authorities, and how it strains all of our relationships. Okay, so clearly it's not the case that any time you have the slightest occasion for anger, you seize upon that as a motive force which will conduct you to the term of blissful reconciliation. Because you know that the airing of all grievances often results in a lot of lonely Friday and Saturday nights. Okay? But we also recognize, I think many of us do, that there can be a certain simplicity to anger. All right, to be able to express anger without rancor is a great gift, and it's also it's very refreshing when we find it in our interactions with others, especially when it's brought to bear by friends. I think of this often because in a poem that he wrote called The Ponto, G.K. Chesterton says, So he says, "The North is full of tangled things and texts and aching eyes, and dead is all the innocence of anger and surprise." And I remember reading that line and thinking, the innocence of anger? Likened unto the innocence of surprise. But then, you know, subsequent reflection and subsequent experience, you know the difference between when you do something to a friend and her eyes light up and she says, "Don't do that again," versus when you do something to a friend and you can see that she has been disquieted and then she departs, she ponders the offense for some time, and then she comes back after days or weeks have elapsed. And it's clear that in her reflections, which are informed by some anger, that she has been meditating upon this hurt without you. And you wish that you could have just been there with her to meditate upon this hurt. It's like, why did you reason without me when we could have reasoned together? I realize now that I hurt you, but I do not want to be alienated as a result of the fact that I hurt you. right? There should be sufficient trust. There should be sufficient love such that we can give this to each other, even in its freshness, even in its innocence, okay? So there's a way in which anger, as we've already discussed, can be ordered to the acknowledgement of a wound and the healing thereof by pardon, by forgiveness, and perhaps even by reconciliation. So that requires two people, so a bit more difficult to manage. Okay, so we want to bring our anger forward. We want to entrust the beloved with our anger without romanticizing it, all right? Without treating it as if it were other than it in fact is, something experienced very intensely, very vehemently, and sometimes very angrily. We want to be able to entrust it to the other such that we can use it for healing, for pardon, for forgiveness, for reconciliation. So we take seriously then the Stoic critique, because the risk of excess and of disorder is real. It's real. This is something that we're told often in religious formation, specifically as it concerns fraternal correction. This doesn't apply perfectly, but it's a helpful concept. Fraternal correction is an expression of beneficence, all right, the doing of the good, which issues from the virtue of charity, right, the love of the other with the love of God. And when you bring before the other your concern, typically you're making the judgment, this thing matters, this person can change, and in some way, shape, or form, I can communicate it with love. Because only in communicating with love can I become thereby an instrument of the Lord's pardon, all right, and of forgiveness, the reconciliation, which will follow in turn. Because you're saying to the other, there's this thing that you are doing or that you are permitting, which is causing in you a kind of hindrance or obstacle to the divine life. And it's, I can see it, and I suspect that you can see it. And I don't know that my words count for anything. I suspect that they count for much less than I esteem them to count, right? But I want to give this to you because I know of no other way in which to communicate it. But I care, and I'm not just venting my spleen. I'm not just frustrated. I'm not just at my wit's end listening to you do this annoying throat-clearing thing in the back of the chapel, right? It's not just because of dot, dot, dot. It's because I care. Well, truth be told, it's because God cares, and I have some taste of that, and I want to impart the savor, all right? So there's this kind of spirit in fraternal correction, namely the spirit of love, which I think captures in higher fashion what we're trying to communicate in virtuous anger. Okay, so when we interrogate our own anger, and when we seek to form it virtuously, we're asking ourselves, is this just about the venting of spleen and self-justification? Or is this about the resolution of conflict and the healing of relationship? All right? And as Sister warned us in the last session, we won't really know the answer to those questions. All right? So we come before ourselves, we come before our friends, we come before our God as beggars for the meanings of our lives. We cannot presume to own them, because we don't. Right? Because His providence is beyond our prudence. And because we are not the masters of our fate. All right? Pache Nelson Mandela. We're not. We exercise some real agency. But within the Aristotelian setting, we require a lot of luck or good fortune. All right? Within the Christian setting, we require a lot of the ponderous mercy of God. Okay, so I just want to interrogate two potential snares in working through anger. The one is an inordinate attachment to justice, and I'll explain what that means. And the other is an inordinate pleasure in resentment or rage. Okay, so an inordinate attachment to justice. Father Gregory, what could you possibly mean by an inordinate attachment to a virtue? Well, I mean it in this specific sense. We have said that anger is most precipitated or is simply precipitated by slights to one's excellence. So when you feel yourself to be scorned or you feel yourself to be reviled, you feel yourself to be forgotten, you feel yourself to be passed over, set aside, otherwise, whatever, unconsidered. It's that which gives rise to anger. And St. Thomas does some work to resolve other cases to that kind of root case. I think that there is a certain tendency, and it's especially acute. Can tendencies be acute? It's especially dangerous. There's a tendency in the 21st century to prefer one's private good to the common good. All right, we're all downstream of post-Enlightenment thought, or I suppose of Enlightenment thought. We are post-Enlightenment thinkers. And regardless of how much we resist those, you know, tendencies in human thought and tendencies in human culture, we have to be cognizant of the fact, aware of the fact, that we are also products of our culture. So for instance, the 21st century in American kind of political discourse is communist. Just is, all right? We're all communists. You might be like, how dare you call me a communist? You know, but when people say, like, how are we going to solve this problem? The way that we typically respond is, let's take this matter over here and, like, push it up against that matter over there, and then maybe things will be better. Okay, that's communism, right? Cool. No, like, we're all dialectical materialists. Very few of us are like, what if, right? We don't think in those terms. We're just like, okay? But it's just good to know that about ourselves. It's just good to know that about ourselves. Yeah, okay, moving on. So I think that in the 21st century, we all basically prefer our private good to the common good. All right? We all basically prefer our private good to the common good. What do I mean by that? Well, when we think about justice, we're typically thinking about in terms of, like, I give you money and you give me a product. All right? I give you money, you give me a product. In the words of the immortal Julius Campbell from Remember the Titans, I'm going to watch out for myself and I'm going to get mine. Okay? Like, a lot of us think in those terms, even if only subtly and simply. But this is not an ideal state of affairs. All right? This is not an ideal state of affairs. Because, as we've tried to stress, you're born into a network of relationships, and those relationships have a claim on your life. All right? You are born a creature, which means that God has a claim on your life. He has a claim to the whole of your life. You're born a son or a daughter of these parents in this country. And so your parents, your country, have a claim on your life. In a certain sense, on the whole of your life. Mind you, the way in which that transpires is dictated by custom. It's also dictated by age and maturity. But still, it's true enough. We all have superiors. All right, whether at work or in our religious community or otherwise, and those superiors have a claim on our life. So in certain religious communities, there can be a tendency to be not only fratricidal, but patricidal, right, or supericidal. You elect a person so that you have an object of your hatred, so there's someone on whom you can offboard your various disappointments and frustrations. You're like, I would have attained to the heights of whatever pertinent discipline, had it not been for the fact that I was held back by this superior, for whom, in the Dominican order, I voted, right? So it's a fascinating phenomenon, right? But there's this tendency to kind of resist those claims, all right? To resist those claims. I think about this. I celebrated Mass for a women's religious congregation this morning, and there was one sister who's very sick and who requires a lot of help. And I was thinking about how much time that takes the other sisters in the community, right? And when those sisters made their profession, they didn't know exactly what they were professing. They had some sense of what they were professing, you know, like this kind of ministry and this kind of common life and these kind of prayers. But they didn't know that it was going to involve taking care of this woman, right? But I have every indication from my limited contact with this congregation that they do it well, right? That they do it beautifully. That's a very human thing. All right, but I think a lot of us, if we were to, you know, take a job and making $42,000 a year here in Washington, D.C., and then some new responsibility were foisted upon us that fell without the bounds of our agreed-upon contract, I think we'd feel deep resentment. We don't have too terribly much in the way of commitment to the companies for which we work. We're going to transfer out of this job within 3 years. Are you kidding? There's something better that waits. I just don't know how attached we are, how committed we are, how engaged we are. And I don't say that by way of condemnation. I'm just saying that we live in the 21st century, just an observance of facts. Okay? So I think that there is a potential snare in the kind of prosecuting of anger that I end up preferring my private good to the common good in a way that actually blinds me from honoring the claims of relationships and the relative importance of persons and issues. Like, I begin to live my life as a vindication of my rights, rather than as a contribution to my relationship or to the relationships which have a claim on me. Another snare, that we might take inordinate pleasure in resentment or rage. As a settled state, and we've already talked about this, or approached it from different angles or vantage points, anger typically resolves itself into sorrow. Because in anger, right, you register the injury, you think in terms of vindication. But if you determine the vindication is impossible, Or if you go so long without exercising vindication, then you begin to despair of its possibility. And then the anger just resolves into a present, unavoidable anger for which we have the name sorrow. Okay? So we can think about this in terms of bitterness or resentment or even melancholy. All right? There are elements of each of these phenomena present in an unresolved anger. All right? So in this state, the injury kind of recedes and then the sadness just foregrounds. So we often lose a sense for what originally happened or the original reasons in light of which the injury registered and the vindication appeared as something desirable. And so in these instances, we can be tempted, I think, to nurse our anger, like a kind of, in the way that Brideshead Revisited, Julia describes nursing her sin like a sick child, to have it always at the breast, because at least there's something that needs us, right? At least there's something that relies upon us for life, right? Because if we don't feel anger, what will there be left to feel? And if we don't feel, will we even exist? That's to be, I don't know if that's too wild of a description. I don't mean to, yeah, again, to romanticize or to make exotic what is in fact quotidian. But yeah, I think that there can be a kind of inordinate pleasure in the resentment, in the rage, if it doesn't actually attain to its term, if it isn't ever actually operationalized. All right, so I think within this, we recognize a need for a certain balance. So we want to establish a genuine rectification of justice within the setting of a genuine communion. All right, to release the emotion or to operationalize the emotion in healthy fashion, lest it resolve to sadness. Okay, so not to prejudge it, not to auto-culpabilize it, but to express it in some way, shape, or form, lest it resolve to sadness. And so here's my proposal. My proposal is that there are two virtues involved in this, and that we need both virtues. Because sometimes the Lord in his generosity gives us two virtues to navigate an experience. Because one virtue does not suffice wholly and entirely. Here's a parallel example. Concerning the desire for great honors, right? We, as human beings, are made for great things. God has vouchsafed that desire and that reality in vouchsafing our nature. So if you read Nicomachean Ethics, book 4, whatever it is, chapter 3, you'll encounter the magnanimous man. So we have a name for this virtuous disposition vis-a-vis honors, right? That we can be well-ordered in our pursuit of great things worthy of great honors precisely because they are great, in recognizing a kind of proportion between our capacity and their grandeur, all right? But there are potential snares in the exercise of magnanimity, and St. Thomas will list various vices opposed thereunto, like vainglory. If it's just about the upbuilding of your ego, a kind of empty pursuit without real substance, can lapse into vainglory. Or ambition, if you fail to refer that glory, that grandeur, to the appropriate person, namely to the God from whom it comes, to those for whom you are sent in service, etc. All right? Or pride, right? That you reach beyond your grasp, or that you think in some way, shape, or form that it's really you who are the protagonist of the saving work. For while it is true, in a subordinated sense, that you are the protagonist, there is a higher sense in which God is the protagonist. And so in his loving kindness, in his generosity, we're given the virtue of humility, which operates on the same matter, okay, which would be the irascible passions of hope and despair, spurring hope, reigning in despair, and sending us in this trajectory towards grandeur or greatness. But what humility does is that it infuses into our members a recognition of the fact that every good and perfect gift comes down to us from the Father of lights. What do you have you have not received? If therefore you have received it, why do you boast as if it were your own? All right, so it safeguards us from arrogating the excellence to ourselves as if it were exclusively or solely ourselves at work in whatever it is. All right, by this kind of cosmic recognition that this is all an expression of the divine generosity, and that Christ has begun a good work in us, he will see it to completion by virtue of some like consent or cooperation. All right, so humility has a way of safeguarding magnanimity, lest it go off the deep end. And I think that what you have here in virtuous anger is a similar phenomenon. So vindication, we have said, is about the rectification of the relationship. It's an expression of sadness. I have been hurt. Hatred. This evil threatens. Of hope. This relationship can be reconstituted, and I judge it worthwhile to attempt to do so, but with a recognition that I am probably going to overdo this. And so vindication is safeguarded by meekness. All right. So let's talk then in this final section about vindication and meekness. I think the whole point of vindication is to address an obstacle that might otherwise eventuate in alienation. Somebody has offended you. That person apologizes. You say, it's no big deal. But in your heart of hearts, it is a big deal, and you're never going to trust that person again. You're going to stop responding to text messages with the same frequency that you did formerly, and you're going to distance yourself by imperceptible means so that there's no big blow-up, there's no big define the relationship, but you can safely rely upon this thing dying in 2 years' time. All right? Vindication safeguards us against that. It pushes us by a stronger impulse to actually invest in the reconciliation, in the rectification, you know, become reconciliation, such that we can lay hold of the relationship and cling fast to what is good if we genuinely believe and hope that it is good and will remain good. So it's an expression of desire for order and of hope in the relationship, right? Pushing aside a tendency to minimalize or to trivialize and saying, yes, this did hurt. Instead of saying, no big deal, saying, I forgive you. Right? Which I'm sure many of our contemporaries would be shocked by hearing those words. Because how very often do you hear them pronounced? Almost never. Because it seems like an offense to acknowledge that you have been hurt and then to offer those words as a way by which to build back. So vindication affects the setting to rights begotten in reason. All right? We're comparing the injury to the punishment. We're making a judgment and we're trying to do it in a way that is just. All right? So this is something for which we're responsible. We have to do this, okay? We're bound in precept to do this. He that spareth the rod hateth his son, says King Solomon in Proverbs. All right? So we have to visit something like punishment upon the offender, even if of the mildest sort, even if wholly softened by mercy. But still, if that kind of punishment doesn't have a punitive aspect, right, then it's like to go off the rails. And you can consult C.S. Lewis in God and the Dock for further details. All right? So this has to be governed by a good object and by a good end, namely that the sinner may amend, that he may be restrained and others be not disturbed, that justice may be upheld and that God may be honored. So that's the basic shape of vindication. A confrontation of the other with the injustice, not having meditated upon it for many days, having grown black in one's heart of hearts, perhaps taking counsel with somebody who's wiser or older or generally saner, but trying to address it as simply and as uncomplicatedly as possible in a kind of openness, right? In a kind of vulnerability, whereby you entrust the other with yourself. I intend to be held in mind and heart. I intend to be held in mind and heart by you, and I will open this question and issue this pardon, not because I am superior, but in a certain sense because I am less, right? Because I have suffered. But I can heal and grow. We can heal and grow. And I have a vested interest in healing and growing rather than holding on to my victim status so that I can always marshal it against you as a potential, you know, wagering point in subsequent conflict. So that's the first, vindication. The second, meekness. When St. Thomas talks about meekness, he says that meekness is the virtue which moderates anger in our interior life. And then the virtue which moderates the expression of anger or the meeting out of punishment, he calls clemency. Okay, so meekness and clemency. But he treats them in the same question because he thinks that they're just the interior and exterior dimension of the same movement of the heart. All right, so what I think meekness and clemency does is that it introduces different pertinent considerations into the matter of vindication. And I've listed them under these headings. Adjusting for choleric temperament. Adjusting for monomaniacal thinking. Adjusting for the other. Adjusting for heaven. So adjusting for choleric temperament. You need to know your own temperamental and constitutional disposition. All right? Some of us are more easily provoked to anger. And when provoked to anger, some of us are more easily provoked to a hot anger, to a blazing wrath. So because of this physical component, it's most likely, or it's more likely, that anger is going to cloud our vision, that it's going to occlude reason, that it's going to cause in us, a certain furor or a certain zeal even, that might potentially send us too hot into the heat of battle. Okay? So it's good to adjust for that. What are simple ways to adjust for that? Deep breaths. Count to 10. Heat check. All right? Write the email and don't send it. Right? We all have different ways in which to go about it. Second, adjusting for monomaniacal thinking. What do I mean by that? Like, left to our own devices, sometimes we spin out whole narratives on our head without ever actually backstopping them against reality. Like, if he did this, it means this, which means this, which means this, which means this. Oh, no. You know? Okay. So this is a risk. It's a real risk. We've all experienced it at some level. All right? So I think it's just good to account for it. All right? It's good to account for it. I think that we need to introduce a kind of principle of, we'll call it epistemic humility. All right? From one vantage, we could say a principle of agnosticism. Like, you just don't know what you don't know, and we need to be honest before that reality. But what the reason for which I say epistemic humility is we need to realize in humility that our knowing is limited. I think that's a more simple claim. All right? Our knowing of ourselves, our knowing of the other, our knowing of the plans of God. Like I said, we come before our lives, we come before ourselves, we come before our friends, we come before God as beggars for the meaning of our lives and of the life that we share. So I think that St. Thomas will say, for instance, that there's a difference in the way that we judge persons and the way that we judge things. He says we can judge things with a kind of severity because they're not going to be hurt by the severity of our judgment. All right? Whereas we should judge people with a kind of mildness because they could be hurt by our judgment. And that doesn't mean mental gymnastics. It just means adjusting for psychological and emotional static, which we can be nigh unto sure will be present in the judgment. All right? This doesn't mean that you have to adopt a kind of St. Thérèse of Lisieux type posture vis-a-vis your contemporaries, all right, trying to convince all of them that you love them best when, truth be told, you find them most annoying, right? Because there can be, I'm not judging St. Thérèse by any stretch of the imagination, but there can kind of be an insincerity to that. But I think that we should try to understand, all right? And I think that when we do understand, we find occasion for mercy. All right, so mercy is an expression, it's a recognition of pity and then a desire to alleviate whatever misery, you know, has caused that pitiable state. And the source of said miserable state might be physical limitations, emotional or psychological limitations. It might be something that person did, whether knowingly or unknowingly, whether competently or incompetently. But if we can get to the heart of that we can actually be of service, right? Be of genuine help. Okay, so adjusting for choleric temperament, adjusting for monomaniacal thinking, adjusting for the other. So when I think about this, I think about there's a boundaries book that we read in formation. We're encouraged to read it with some frequency. It's just called Boundaries. Cloud and Townsend are the authors, both of whom are Christian. And they'll say in that book that when you permit yourself to experience it, oftentimes anger signals transgressed boundaries. All right? Sometimes in relationships, we do everything within our power to accommodate the other. And Sister describes some of the kind of mental torture to which individuals will subject themselves as they try to convince themselves that they are, in fact, the source of the problem. But you can see why one might endeavor to do such a thing, because it's easier than actually troubleshooting the problem. Because if you interiorize it, if you auto-culpabilize it, then you have a kind of control over it, albeit a terrible control. But you prevent anger from flaring up in a way that you find ungovernable, or simply ugly, immoral, whatever else. But when you come into a deeper recognition of the fact that, no, my boundaries have in fact been transgressed, right? That something in this relationship is disordered or unhealthy, and that I need to reestablish my own proper integrity, or I need to establish my own proper place, then anger might in fact be the emotion which supplies the moral energy to accomplish that. And you're going to need to let yourself be angry. All right? You're going to be able to feel that anger. Because otherwise, you might cow in fear at the first sign of confrontation. Because you don't want to lose that relationship. Nobody wants to lose a relationship. Or you don't want to endure whatever conversations might follow upon, you know, the redress of the wrong. Right? It all takes time. It all takes emotional energy. It all costs. Right? But you can trust anger when it's often signaling, when it is signaling that transgression of boundary. All right? So there's that on the one hand. But then another kind of pertinent factor when I think about adjusting for the other is accounting for the fragility of the human person addressed. Okay? As T.S. Eliot wrote, humankind cannot bear very much reality. Okay? So the person doesn't need to experience the full weight or the full brunt of your anger. Typically, just a hint of it, a touch of it, is sufficient to communicate what you want to communicate. Like we've all experienced this. I don't know if you've experienced this, but the worst thing you can get from your mother is disappointment. Right? Like, woof. When she gets angry, you're like, but I can just cuddle into your shoulder and then this will all be fine. And she's like, oh, but you are cute. You know, when she cries, you're like, ooh, would you like some ice cream? You know, like, but when she's disappointed, you're like, I want to die. I wish I could decreate myself. Right? So you don't need to express the full weight or the full brunt of your anger because we're all fragile, and especially in the 21st century. The image that Father Bonaventure will use to describe this is, he often sends me a GIF of Higgins boats. I don't know if you're familiar with Higgins boats, but they are the landing craft that was used at Operation Overlord on D-Day, where American GIs went up on the beach there in Normandy, and then the gate dropped, and then the German gunners just opened up, and like the first, you know, 15 guys all just went down in the primes of their lives. He often asks the question, are we preparing people to board a Higgins boat, or are we fragilizing? Not to say that the point of our lives is to die on a beach far from home. I don't mean to glorify warfare as if it were the very point for which we came into this world, because it's not. Right? But there is a kind of moral solidity which we do seek, such that we can make sacrifices, if not of the ultimate sort, at least of a certain sort. And I don't know that we're doing that right now. Okay? I'm not convinced. So I think that we do need to adjust for the fragility of the other, but we're also trying to confront the other in such a way as to elicit a mature, a responsible response. And then the final point, and then time for questions, is adjusting for heaven. Heaven is the ultimate horizon of vindication. It's only in the resurrection that all is set right. Until such time, we are in a veil of tears. I contribute to this podcast called Godsplaining, and our like tagline at the outset was contemplative preachers, contemporary age. But I could never get it right, as just evidenced. So we switched to conversation for conversion, which I think is better. But I think that the tagline ought ultimately to be whimsy in the veil of tears, because I think that that's what we're actually doing. Every episode begins with like, ah! And we're like, oh, we could, you know, maybe stumble our way towards the truth. But I think that when we, you know, give expression to our anger, we do have to adjust for heaven, because we want a kind of terminal resolution to our problems, and we won't get it. We won't get it here, right? We just won't. That doesn't mean that we suffer injustice, that we interiorize the wrong, that we auto-culpabilize because we don't actually think that anything here can be saved or changed or transfigured. But it does mean that we're not going to expect it all to make sense. Why do the wicked prosper? Will not God revenge his elect who cry to him day and night? So I think that this affords us as Christians, and it's kind of sneaky, we've left this off until the end, this affords us as Christians the only like kind of full and wholly real consolation in and through conformity to Christ, who has taken our human nature to himself. He has taken a human soul and a human body, human intellect, human will, and human emotions, even the defects associated with human sin while not incurring sin himself. So he has taken our anger, all right, as a way by which to bear it up in God, unto God. So we know that our anger has a home in God. And so practically speaking, when we experience what is often a mix of anger and sadness, because it usually comes by way of a mix of anger and sadness, we can begin our holy hour by saying, Jesus, I'm angry and sad. And we don't actually have to say anything else, because you can wait and hope that the Lord, who has begun a good work in his Christ, will see that work to completion in you by virtue of the conformity which is effected in faith and sacrament. Because in faith he applies it to you spiritually. In sacrament, he applies it to you bodily. The Lord is applying his rectification of justice, whereby we are reconciled to God through his flesh to yours, such that it resonates out from your heart to your members, from the soles of your feet to the top of your head. So Christ, who gives us an example of vindication and of meekness, right, is able to bear it up unto God. I think about this often. On the one hand, we hear from the suffering servant, like a lamb led to the slaughter, he opened not his mouth. And in the actual moment when he is put to the test, Christ answers, if I have spoken wrongly, bear witness to the wrong. But if I have spoken rightly, why do you strike me? Right? So we need not fear that our anger has not a home in heaven, because it's already there in Christ. Right? And we can have the confidence, we can have the certainty and the confidence that Christ will heal ours and grow ours until such time as it is wholly his.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.